You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of these crises. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with my one good friend, Dr. Stephen Kissler, an epidemiologist at the Harvard School of Public Health. How are you on this incredibly spring month-ish?
It is spring. It's actually sort of like raining really hard the last couple of days here in Boston, which is springtime here. So yeah, it's finally getting warmer, and boy, man, it always feels like a miraculous thing when you emerge out of the Boston winter, because it's just so cold and so long and so dark. So yeah, everybody's feeling it.
That's good. Yeah, I cannot imagine. I'm so used to Colorado 3 days of cloudy a year. And those three days I'm like really angry at life, and then I feel bad because most of the other world has many more cloudy days. So I'm sorry for those who were probably expecting a podcast episode on Monday. Good news for me is I got a job, another job. So I've been doing other random stuff. Got a more full-time gig, started on Monday. So the first few days were kind of crazy. So this might be an ever evolving, changing, shifting release. And I know I haven't even told Steven yet, but I'll be gone for over a month in May. And so we'll figure that out away from Colorado. So there might be some times where we might not have an episode right on time, but we're still going to strive hard to be as regular as humanly possible. And regular, I mean that on episode wise, not like biologically or like regular. So I'm always striving for that at 44. So I don't know whether I should cut that out and keep that. I'll find that out. I'll determine that later on.
All right.
But before we get going, the regular good stuff. If you can leave us a review, we love it. Haven't had one in a few weeks. Just get inspired by those little drops of notes. You can do that on Apple Podcasts. There's another platform you can do that as well. We'd love that. Give us a rating. Also, patreon.com/pandemicpodcast, as little as $5 a month, can help us keep this going, or just a one-time gift, PayPal, Venmo, all in the show notes. Okay, so it has been a little over 2 weeks, Stephen. I feel like there's a decent amount to cover, which is always interesting, because I keep thinking that at some point in time, we're going to just sit here and stare at each other for 45 minutes and then close up shop and they can hear us breathing. But there's still stuff to talk about. But the first thing I want to check in with you is just dealing with the variant. There's BA2. I just read an article this morning about this, I guess, a BA3 that's kind of sitting around not doing much, but who knows. But you want to give us a status of where we're at with BA2, because we've heard Europe having increasing cases. There's been a lot of news articles about expecting a surge here. We've definitely seen an uptick, but nothing dramatic. Is it BA2? Is it more than that? What should we be expecting this summer? Fill us in on that.
Yeah, so we're sort of in this spot where it's really hard to tell. For a lot of the pandemic, we have trailed Europe in our case counts. You know, it's pretty much like when Europe goes up, then we go up pretty consistently about a month or so later. You know why that is? I'm not totally sure, but it seems to have been a relatively consistent pattern. And so, and actually, to a large extent, that is what we're seeing now. We're starting to see an uptick in cases in some parts of the country. I know here in the Northeast, we've just surpassed the point where BA2 is making up more than half of the COVID cases that are being sequenced. So it's now a majority of what's circulating here. And as Europe is to the US, oftentimes the coasts of the US are to the rest of the country. And so since we're starting to see that rise in the proportion of BA2 cases here, I think that we can probably expect that to happen across much of the rest of the country. But the big question is, like, you know, how big and how long will it be? I am not yet convinced that it's going to be a major feature of our springtime COVID experience here in the US. And that's to a large extent because we've had BA2 circulating in the US for quite some time. We've had introductions of BA2 here all the way back since December. And so I think that if it were going to do something really, you know, huge and sharp and sudden, it probably would have done so already. Now, that's not to say that we're not going to see a rise in cases, because there may be some, you know, strange interactions with previous immunity and waning immunity, and, you know, the fact that our behaviors are changing quite a bit. Mandates are sort of lifting just about everywhere. And, you know, certainly my behavior has changed over the last month or two. I've been seeing people more, I've been out and about more. And so all of that is going to contribute too. So I think the most important thing is to note that, you know, BA2 is probably more infectious, more transmissible than the original Omicron variant, but it's the difference between BA1 and BA2 is nowhere near the difference between Delta and BA1. So we're going to start to see BA2 start to take over, but I think that a lot of the surge that we're seeing is actually probably behaviorally driven. And I think we're going to be helped by the fact that this is happening as we're going into the spring, as it's easier to move some of these interactions outdoors. And so hopefully that'll help prevent this from turning into a major surge, and it'll just be sort of one of those blips that we're probably going to be dealing with for a very, very long time.
Yeah, I can imagine. And yeah, you kind of already hit it already, but it seems like this is not necessarily just a BA2 reality when it comes to this uptick in the US. You mentioned the idea of our behaviors are changing. We're going to get into the next part of our little discussion about policies, guidelines, and the CDC. And is that a good move of the CDC? Is it, you know, the government funding starting to go away? So there's a lot of things that are kind of coming down the pipeline that are going to change this summer dramatically. But hitting one more part of this kind of uptick in the US, I read an article. This is great. Every once in a while, I hit an article and like, oh, that's Steven. He's actually in there. So there was a CNN one where you were quoted talking about one of the kind of the metrics is looking at the 65 and older group of seeing what's going to happen. Can you talk more about that as we begin to venture forward and kind of see how do we plan for any future surges, cases? What things we need to be looking for and monitoring? And this other article I talked about, which is deeply related, I think it was by The Atlantic, about this increased desire to look at another metric, which is kind of the immunity surveillance. And so clearly we can watch the 65 and older group as they enter into the hospital. But I feel like that's kind of a little bit late. Are there other things that we're doing, preparing to help be a little more preventative to see, okay, when should we take different measures? When should we encourage the 65 and older group to take the second booster when that becomes available? Those kind of things.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, with the thoughts about the, you know, immunity in the 65 and older age group, it's really based off of a couple of things. You know, first, back in, gosh, I don't even remember what year it is anymore. It was when vaccines were sort of first coming online. So I guess it was like end of 20, beginning of 2021. There was a lot of asking about, you know, how should we prioritize vaccine doses, and should we prioritize it to interrupt transmission, which would suggest vaccinating young adults, or should we prioritize it to reduce severity of disease primarily, which would prioritize vaccinating the elderly, and sort of prioritizing vaccination by age group, that with each, you know, as you get older, the more important it is that you get vaccinated. And based off of the modeling and the information that we had about the severity of COVID by age, it really seemed that it was by far and away the best strategy to vaccinate the oldest people first. And that's really been kind of supported by some, well, and I think we'll probably talk about this in a little while too, but the experience in Hong Kong. So one of the really big issues that seems to be in play in Hong Kong is that they were able to keep cases low for a very long time, but there's been a lot of vaccine hesitancy amongst the older age groups. And that has led to a really big surge in hospitalizations and deaths in Hong Kong that really hasn't been seen in other countries like New Zealand, for example, where there's higher vaccine uptake amongst the older age groups, but have had a similar experience with COVID previously, where it was kept suppressed to very low levels. So both the modeling and the real world experience suggest that the more immunity you have in the oldest age groups, the better you're going to fare as a society overall. I think that it's, you know, this is another one of those examples where it's really difficult to reason when we're thinking about exponential relationships instead of linear relationships. So when I'm talking about the risk of hospitalization and death increasing with age, I don't mean that it's a linear increase where it's like with each year, your risk goes up by a fixed amount. It's really pretty much exponential, right? So like as you get older, the risk just increases so much that if you compare the risk of hospitalization and death for somebody who's over the age of 80, for example, that's, you know, the risk of somebody who's much younger really, really pales in comparison. And so that's really why, you know, getting back to this quote in this article, why I really think that one of the most important indicators for how communities are going to fare as we move forward is vaccination rates and immunity rates in the oldest members of our population. Now, I do want to say that this also extends to other groups who are vulnerable. You know, it's not just the elderly who are vulnerable to severe outcomes. In many ways, that's sort of the largest and easiest group to identify with a single category. But we can ask ourselves, you know, what is it that makes people who are elderly more vulnerable to severe disease from COVID-19? So part of it is the immune response, that as you get older, your immune system just doesn't get fired up as easily. And so of course, that also then extends to people who are immunocompromised. It extends to people with comorbidities that either prevent them from mounting a good immune response or that make them more likely to have severe COVID outcomes. Because again, as you're elderly, you tend to have more cardiovascular conditions. You tend to have the rates of obesity increase, the rates of diabetes increase. So all of those things independently also affect your risk of severe disease from COVID-19. So we really want to make sure immunity is high in those populations as well. But again, if you had to sort of say, you know, if I had to, you know, if I had 10 seconds to tell you what my strategy would be for yeah. getting communities through this, I would have to stick with that oldest age groups, because that sort of does the best job of sort of encapsulating all of that together. Yeah. So that's a long-winded answer to the first part of your question. I know you had another one about immune correlates too, but yes. Let me know if you want to dive off on another tangent.
No, that's great. I think let's go into that, because I think just understanding, because you were setting the stage for this, but then how do we begin to prep or monitor and have immunity surveillance as being a key criteria for us to be ahead of the curve a little bit? In a different perspective of monitoring when these people, I can kind of see how you might be able to do this on a macro level. We're kind of already doing this, like, oh, it looks like immunity response decreases around 6 or 7 months, but maybe even getting to a particular response as part of your, in my mind, like part of your physical, your annual physical. Maybe there's something down the road that encompasses where you're at on particular antibodies for vulnerable diseases, right?
Totally. Yeah. You know, and so, yeah, a couple of thoughts on that. I think you're absolutely right that really what we're talking about here is amount of immunity. And ideally what we would be able to measure is a person's antibodies or other immune responses to a given pathogen, which it correlates with vaccination and previous infection, but it's not perfect. It's a pretty noisy correlation, right? What we've seen from studies where people have been looking at antibodies in the blood is that people really do have a very wide range of responses to the vaccine and a previous infection. And while it's very much true that on average, your protection increases with increasing exposures, there are some people who just really repeatedly just don't mount a very good response at all. And so it would be really worth understanding who those people are and what we can do. Again, like I said, you know, for some individuals who already know that they have some kind of immune compromised condition, that makes sense. They have reason to suspect that they might be one of these people who don't respond well. But for some other people, it might be random, or, you know, there may be some underlying condition that they're not aware of. And that leads to this huge amount of variation between people. So I do think, you know, we're not yet at the point where we can do serology for COVID-19 on sort of a widespread population basis and then say, like, you know, like your immune response hasn't been very good, you would really benefit from another dose of the vaccine, or you might want to take these list of precautions. But that realistically, I think that may be a direction that we're heading with immunity to both COVID-19 and other infectious diseases. There are certain infections for which we already do this for people who are working in healthcare, for example. So for, I think it's hepatitis B, if you're going to be working in a hospital, frequently you have to basically get an antibody titer. You do a serology, and most of us are vaccinated for hep B. But if your titer isn't up to snuff, you get a booster before you go into the hospital. And so there's already a sort of a paradigm for this, but it's pretty reserved to really only the groups who need it most. But my hope is that as we move forward, we'll both see the value in this kind of testing, and also the cost of doing these kinds of tests will go down as the interest and investment in them goes up. And so hopefully that'll mean that it's no longer just reserved to the people who, you know, are working in hospitals, who admittedly are the ones who really have, you know, they're the ones who need to be getting this, that sort of test right now. But it would be wonderful to start to see that become more widely available for COVID-19, for other infectious diseases, because it really is that's really what we're trying to measure here is how immune you are, and not necessarily how many doses of a vaccine that you've gotten.
Yep. Great. And do you expect then this for like the second booster dose, or the fourth, if you're taking Pfizer or Moderna, as being like a common thing that's going to be in this fall? Like, are we, like, for, you know, we kind of didn't know, initially thinking that, oh, maybe like that initial booster is going to take us far, like maybe a year or two, 3 years down the road. I don't know where we're at for research with how long. It seems like even the booster, some articles say maybe 6 months. Again, it might start to wane a little bit given the prevalence of Omicron and this kind of stuff. Are you going to Do you see that this fourth dose being pretty much a not required, but a highly recommended thing for 65 and older come this fall or even sooner?
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I haven't really reviewed the data very closely on the fourth dose, you know, additional booster kind of another dose in the series. I know that it has been, I think it already has been approved and even recommended for people over 50 by the FDA and CDC. But I really kind of would love to dig into the data a little bit more, because as far as I can tell, it does seem like the booster has provided a substantial and more durable response than the initial series did. And I think there are still some questions as to how durable that response is and also what there is to gain by getting a fourth dose. Absolutely. I think that, like, if you get another dose of the vaccine, it's going to rev up your immune system again. And that's probably a good thing. You know, it will give you more protection, but there are also all of these different layers of protection that we need to bear in mind. It does seem like the booster goes a very long way and does a very durable, consistent job of protecting people from hospitalization and death. I imagine that a fourth dose will probably go even further and help prevent people from getting symptoms in the first place, which is great. But it's not clear to me how much added benefit there will be in the severe disease camp. And part of it is just because I don't know that we've collected the data. And even if we have, I admittedly have not been able to dig into it much yet. But that's definitely, you know, that's been a big topic over the last couple of weeks. So it's something I'm going to be looking at soon. So hopefully we'll be able to dig into that a little bit more in the near future.
Great. Great. Well, let's get in. You mentioned the CDC. Let's talk about that now, because now we're seeing, you know, all the guidelines of the CDC. We talked about this just over 2 weeks ago and how some of the good, some of the pros, some of the cons of the changings, how now with the new guidelines, what was considered high risk for a particular state is now low risk, and there's different criteria. And now on top of that, we have this layer of funding being removed. So I just want to get your insights of where you're thinking about the direction of the lack of funding. It seems like, in my mind, I just kind of thought things were like they were gearing up. We're establishing kind of a new maintenance routine of how to deal with infectious disease. And once this funding goes away, it can go in like autopilot and keep going. But it sounds like things will just drop, maybe. Like things that were installed that are helpful are going to no longer have funding and they're going to be removed. And where do you see all this going? What would you, and my biggest thing is, what I don't see clearly is I read these articles about complaining about the funding being dropped, but I don't see too often these benchmarks of like, well, we didn't reach this benchmark, so we need X amount of more months. It's just more like we need the funding. And for me, it's like, oh, that could go on forever and we can't do that forever. But do you see like a benchmark that we haven't quite got to that you would say, oh, we should keep this funding? Or where do you see yourself in the midst of all this?
Yeah, you know, it's hard, and this gets into, you know, the complexities of national budgets, which I have zero experience. Because you're right, it's like, you know, absolutely, I think we need to be maintaining a consistent and responsive approach to managing COVID-19 cases in the U.S., but it is one of many priorities as a country, and so it's like hard to know how to weigh those things together. So of course, I think that, you know, dropping funding altogether from COVID-19 response would be a huge mistake. I don't think that's really what's being proposed. What I would really hope to see as we move forward is, you know, it does seem to me like we're beginning to move out of a phase. And I think this is, you know, an accurate reading on the part of sort of the general political milieu, you know, that we're moving out of this crisis phase of the pandemic and moving into a management phase. Some of that has to do with epidemiological factors. You know, we've been through a major wave of cases that actually didn't translate to hospitalizations and deaths at quite the same rate as it had been before. So that's a good move. Cases are relatively low right now. We're going into spring and summer when historically cases have been, you know, nationally sort of more manageable. So if there were ever a time to sort of regroup and evaluate where we want to go forward with this, you know, this is it. And so I think that, you know, what really makes sense to do is to maintain funding in the areas that will allow us to respond quickly and efficiently to new surges. So it's still possible that a new variant could emerge at any time and we'll have to deal with it in short order, right? And so I want to make sure that we, you know, we have the resources to do that. And so it remains true that, like, having a, you know, a stockpile of vaccines makes sense. And that's partly informed by the fact that, you know, two doses of an mRNA didn't help all that much against Omicron, but three very much did. It could be that in a future variant, 3 may not help as much, but 4 will. I don't know for sure, but it makes sense to have some amount on hand to vaccinate, especially the vulnerable, very quickly. It makes sense to have tests available, so maintaining investment in rapid tests and making sure that they're available and that you don't have to like go searching through, you know, 20 different CVSs to find one like we have in the past. Like that makes sense. And those things don't really expire very quickly. So I think making sure that we have a good stockpile of those makes sense. Pharmaceuticals, again, like those things we can really stockpile and make sure that we have on hand. And so my sense is that as long as we have enough of those things available to deal with an impending surge in short order, then it's okay to sort of back off of some of the other funding for maintenance. And I will say that, you know, there are other areas where the government and the CDC have been investing in sort of a longer term approach towards managing infectious diseases, including like funding this new Center for Outbreak Analytics that's going to be doing a lot of modeling, a lot of surveillance, both for COVID-19 and for other infectious disease threats. So my hope is that some of that funding that is being taken away from COVID-specific efforts will also be transitioned into sort of thinking about, okay, what's next? And I think that's probably the best thing that we can do at this point.
Good. I like that. Yeah. Moving things from like an acute allocation for acute crisis to more of a long-term maintenance of systems to put in place to govern and grow this. Okay. You know, the one other thing on this kind of area is my friend's this A4A article from Airlines, America for Airlines, kind of provoking the airlines to reconsider relinquishing masks and particularly the testing, you know, before you come back home, and showing like the economic downturn, people not wanting to go and travel overseas because they're afraid of getting stuck. And there, you know, this letter kind of provided the scientific evidence that this isn't necessary. I don't know if you wanted to weigh in on that, or if you could, like epidemiologically, is there any kind of support for continued masks in the airport at this point in time, and like testing, and you know, do you have any opinion on where this stands for when it comes to airlines and their next move for the summer?
Yeah, I think that with the testing issue, it's tricky because, you know, like you said, it does, you know, there is this concern of being stuck somewhere, and that, I mean, yeah, it's like, I don't know, is that better than flying with COVID-19 and going to the airport? Like, maybe so. So I'm hesitant to say that, like, yeah, we should just sort of drop the testing requirement. But I do recognize, you know, that maybe the added benefit of test when people are getting on an airplane is not that great when we're not actually testing anywhere else. Most of the spread that's happening right now is not coming from travelers, you know, coming from other places. I think that testing makes a lot of sense in the context of a new variant when we're trying to sort of slow the spread of something like Omicron, and their testing makes an awful lot of sense.
Sure.
Now, it's kind of hard to say. It's kind of everywhere. And so it's like, you know, spreading it through an air, like you're just as likely to get it anywhere else as you are in an airport or on the airplane. When it comes to masks, I think that honestly, I don't plan to ditch my mask in airports anytime soon. There were times way before the pandemic that I kind of felt like I should be wearing a mask anyway, but sure, Felt a little weird about it, you know? And that's, I don't think the masks are keeping anyone from traveling. I could be wrong, but I, you know, like that's, and there, you know, also the other thing is that the masks are probably most important while you're in the airport. I had this funny experience the last time I was traveling where, you know, there's somebody who was like wearing an N95 around their neck, and you know, while they were waiting in line to get on the airplane, and then as soon as they got on the airplane, they like put on the mask, and it's like, it's, you know, in many ways that's kind of the opposite of what you want to do, because it's in the airport where you're not going to have as good ventilation and you're mixing with a ton of different people. Once you're on the airplane, like you're probably sharing air with maybe the people right next to you, but otherwise like those things have HEPA filters and like a huge number of air transitions and such, so it's like actually the risk of spread on an airplane is not huge. And so I could see an argument for saying like, be masked at airports, but then you can like be less stringent about them on the airplane. Yeah. I think that would also really help. I know that a lot of poor flight attendants have had a lot of issues with compliance of masks on planes, right? And there's been a lot of sort of like argumentation and even violence. And so like, if it helps with that, then great. You know, if we can say like, you know what, masks are optional when you're actually on the airplane. And if that, you know, makes flight attendants' jobs easier, then absolutely, I can get behind that, because I actually am not convinced that masks do a huge amount of help when you're actually on the airplane, but in the airport, definitely. So those are sort of some of the things that I'm thinking about as I'm thinking about changing policies with travel.
Great. Love the distinction. So let's get into quickly to Hong Kong, because this, it's, you know, total change shift of what's been happening there. We'd just love to get your insights of like what happened, you know, and this is a non-political statement, honestly, but I felt like when I was reading some of these articles, some of the aftermath of what's happened to Hong Kong felt like a mini America, a mini US, like the lack mm-hmm. of trust and vaccine hesitancy, all these kind of similar overtures that we have here as well, but clearly just being riddled with hospitalizations. Just want to get your reflections on what's going on there and what happened that created that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. So Hong Kong is a really interesting sort of case in, you know, thinking about the management of COVID-19. I mean, if for any listeners who haven't had a chance to look at, you know, the data, you know, cases and deaths in Hong Kong lately, it's pretty remarkable. I've got it pulled up right now next to me. You could just type into Google Hong Kong COVID cases and it's like flatline for like all the way up until, you know, a few months ago, like nothing. And then there's this huge surge and that's, you know, driven by the Omicron variant. And so, you know, one of the other things I want to pull up here is, so looking also at, for example, COVID-19 cases in New Zealand. So in many ways, prior to the Omicron surge, New Zealand and Hong Kong had actually pretty similar experiences with the virus in the sense that they were able to get it out early and keep it out for essentially the duration of the pandemic up until this point. And then lately, you know, they've been relaxing travel restrictions. And so that's, you know, inevitably COVID has been able to spread. But one of the big issues in Hong Kong seems to be the fact that, again, the older age groups, there's been a lot more vaccine hesitancy amongst those groups. There's been lower vaccination rates amongst those groups than there have been, for example, in New Zealand, where despite a pretty big surge in cases, the number of deaths has remained pretty low, really an order of magnitude lower than what we've seen in Hong Kong. And so I really think it comes down to that in very large part. And I think, you know, what a lot of this speaks to is that these issues of vaccine hesitancy, of trust in the medical establishment, of really just evaluating personal risk and thinking about vaccination as such, like these are not American issues. These are not necessarily like American and European issues. You know, these are really human issues, and they look different in different places for sure. But we have some really sort of deep questions to resolve here. And so I think that, you know, the short explanation of this is really just like differences in which age groups have been most highly vaccinated. But that really points towards a much bigger issue of like, what is it about vaccination that makes some people more likely to accepted and others less? And yeah, just like what can we do about lack of trust in the medical establishment? What can we do about misinformation? What can we do about, you know, often there are many people who have very good reasons to not get vaccinated, but then like, what do we do to make sure that we hear and honor those reasons as well? You know, and I think those are questions that we don't really have good answers to. And unfortunately in Hong Kong, we're seeing that, you know, the lower rates of vaccination seem to have had a heavy toll. And I think that just points to all the more the need to answer these questions all the more urgently.
That's great. And I think also part of that, I'm not too familiar with all the Hong Kong stuff, but they rolled out a vaccine really early and they chose not to go with the Pfizer one and some other one. And I don't even know if anybody knows the data on that particular vaccine. So you have vaccine hesitancy on top of a vaccine that was rolled out early. And I'm not entirely sure how good it is
against
the Omicron, whereas Pfizer and Moderna are just pretty, pretty good, especially with the booster. So a lot of different threads coming together to form a pretty big mess in Hong Kong right now.
Yep.
So next, one thing I wanted to mention just briefly, you mentioned this early on, maybe like a month or two ago, WHO says most likely scenario shows COVID severity will decrease over time, which is just another layer of, right, as we begin to unfold restrictions and do more things. It's like this is another kind of prophetic voice, whether it's right or not, we don't know, right? It's most like it could be different, but again, another reason to, or incentive to decrease the measures by which we, you know, funding, those kind of things, relax matter, because we're expecting it to be better down the road, even though it's not necessarily true, right?
And I think an important point with that is that it's not necessarily the inherent severity of COVID that's going to decrease over time. I think that that's another element of this story in Hong Kong too, is that there's been a lot of sort of, you know, claims that, oh, Omicron is just like a wimpier version of COVID-19, but actually it's a testament to our immune systems. And I think what we're seeing in Hong Kong is that Omicron is every bit as severe, maybe not as Delta, but certainly as the pre-Delta variants of COVID-19. But in much of the rest of the world, we've got a lot more immunity built up, either through through vaccination or through multiple rounds of previous infection. And that's the story there. It's not necessarily that SARS-CoV-2 is evolving to become less severe. It could. I'm not saying that that's out of the picture, but that doesn't seem to be what's happened so far. I think what's behind this statement is that the critical piece of this and the way in which severity decreases is by increasing immunity. And I think that's useful because that points to two different ways that we can respond to it. You know, one, we can just sort of sit and wait for the virus to get wimpier. But I don't think that's realistic because immunity is actually something that we can be proactive about. We can think about vaccination. We can think about ways of getting boosted. We can think about, you know, making sure that the people who are immunocompromised are protected in all the ways that they need to be protected. And that's how we decrease COVID severity over time.
That's great. Thanks for that nuance. It's really that's great. So now when it comes to detecting COVID, I just want to drop this as well. A new PCR test can identify all SARS-CoV-2 variants in a positive patient sample. This seems pretty cool. Even going down, like even color coding, whether it's an Omicron, Delta, so I'm not sure they'll get to the point where like I get my little slip, say you're positive and you got Delta or, you got Omicron. I'm not sure I'll get that. But what ramifications does this have for surveillance if this becomes a commonplace, a common way by which we test?
Yeah. Yeah. So, this is great. I'm going to geek out a little bit if that's all right, if you'll indulge me for a few moments. Right. So do you know how like in a computer colors are stored, like the little data structures? Usually it's just like a string of numbers. They're like numbers and symbols. So there are a lot of different ways to do it, but one of the most common ways is a hex code. So they're basically six digits that encapsulate a color. And with that, you can encapsulate a ton of different colors. Another way of doing it is by a slightly longer string that's just binary. So ones and zeros that basically give you, different shades and hues and things like that. And the longer the string, the more, the more binary digits that you have, the more precisely you're able to articulate specifically what color you're talking about. And so essentially what they're talking about with PCR detection of new variants is exactly the same principle, but on a molecular scale. So essentially what PCR is able to do is to give you a yes-no answer if a specific short genetic sequence is present in a sample that you're trying to test. So with existing PCR tests, it's actually not just testing a single genetic sequence for SARS-CoV-2. It's actually three different sequences that are present on different parts of the virus. And for SARS-CoV-2, since it's an RNA virus, they're testing for sequences of RNA. So basically just little strings of RNA letters and seeing if they're present in a nasal swab. And one of the reasons that previously we've been able to distinguish between, for example, Alpha and Delta or Delta and Omicron is because with each of those transitions, one of those three sequences that we're testing for is mutated in the virus. And so it drops out. And so now you sort of have this binary string where a Delta infection probably represents a 1-1-1 in each of those different things. It's a success. Like each of those targets has been identified. Whereas an Alpha or an Omicron infection would be like a 0-1-1 because one of them drops out. The S gene target drops out, whereas the other two targets remain. Well, there's no reason why we just have to test for two or three different parts of the virus. We could test for 10 or 15, or we could think more about which three we want to use in a PCR to test the virus. And so essentially what you can do is you can identify parts of the virus that differ between variants, and you can use those as your tags. And so by doing that, if one set of those tags amplify in one sample, you can say, well, this is probably BA1. And then if a different set, you can say, well, that's BA2, because you happened to include in your tags a little bit of the sequence that distinguishes BA1 from BA2. So to do this, you really have to have a good sense of what the variants are, what their sequences are. And we actually do have a pretty good sense of that. But once you do that, then you can actually make these what we call like multiplex PCR tests, where you're testing sort of multiple parts of the viral genome and you're testing the pieces that give you the most amount of information about which variant it is. And then you sort of read out this binary code. And based on what that code is, you can get a very good certainty about which variant it actually is that a person is infected with in the same amount of time that it takes to run regular PCR, because that's really just what we're doing already. So that's the idea behind this. It's pretty cool because it would allow us to do much better surveillance of what is circulating where and the relative prevalence of different strains in a given population without actually having to sequence everything. You can just rely on the PCR tests. So this won't allow you to detect new variants necessarily unless you start to see some really strange binary sequences that don't match anything that you've seen before. And then you'll have to do the sequencing to figure out what's going on. But this can go a long way towards helping us figure out what's actually the things that we already know of, what's circulating in a population at a given time.
That's great. I'm guessing this is probably huge because I know we used to say that UK led genomic research, and that's a separate industry, so to speak. And now if you can build into the PCR, which is already mainstream, that's going to almost like exponentially grow our capacity to do surveillance in the US. And I feel like, I mean, I guess if it's comprehensive enough, like you said, that then new variants that come up, hopefully we'll see an anomaly. That's weird. And then that weird allows us to like start exploring earlier than maybe, you know. So that's, I'm not sure when, I'm guessing, is this something that's going to be down the road mainstream that it's going to take some logic, some checks and balances before we're going to use this as a replacement? Or can this be a quick turnaround? Like, oh, let's just start using these next week.
Yeah. You know, in theory, we could start using these next week. You know, it would take a while to sort of like, you know, distribute and make all the reagents and figure all of that out for sure. But changing the set of targets that you're testing for is a pretty routine thing to do with PCR tests. So if you have access to a lab, you could do this tomorrow. And if you know how to do PCR, I don't, I have no idea how to run a PCR, but people do, you know, but I think, you know, that is to say that the technical challenge is minimal. It's just a matter of deciding, you know, if this is something of public value to do. And if so, finding the resources to sort of update the infrastructure that we already have and update it to this new sort of version of PCR testing.
Great. Fabulous. Okay. So next part here, we're getting close to the end. Another interesting article I read, and I know this was interesting to you because you read this as well, said the surprising link between COVID-19 and deaths is internet access. Now this thing, when I read it, got me excited, but it also made me a little weary. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, can this really be true? The internet access, and they, you know, they can't get some. So, and I'm glad I brought it to you because you say this is a great segue of helping understand the audience or get people up to speed of how to be able to look at this data and see the nuances behind, you know, what's real, what's not, what's complicated, what needs to be considered in light of this. So I'm going to allow you to take it away. And what were your first impressions when you read this article and the nuances behind it?
Yeah. Right. So I think, you know, when you hear a headline like this, the first thing that should immediately spring to your mind is correlation is not causation, right? Like totally. That's like, you know, if that, and I hope that at this point in the pandemic, that is just drilled into everyone's heads. And anytime you hear a causal claim, immediately those alarm bells should come up and you should ask, like, is this a relationship or is this a causal link between two different things? That said, you know, digging into this article, they really did go to great lengths to try to, what we call in statistics, to control for different variables that could be other explanations for this difference in COVID-19 rates for people who have internet versus who don't. Like the obvious ones being like socioeconomic status or urban and rural location. There are a lot of different things that you could say like, oh, well, this is just a proxy for this other thing. And that's what's actually driving the difference. Well, there are ways that you can at least sort of nominally adjust for these different factors to sort of include them in the analysis and say like, no, even when we've adjusted for all of these different things, there still seems to be this difference associated with internet access. Now that still doesn't go so far as saying that that's the cause. The other thing is that there could still be some underlying factors that are not yet perfectly accounted for by the other variables that you've put into your analysis. But it does make that link a little bit stronger, you know, where it's like, well, we can't just totally discount this difference in COVID cases by individuals who have or don't have internet access at home. And so it begs for a further look. So the first thing, you know, I think, you know, we can first play with the idea that maybe there is a difference. Maybe there is a causal link and we can start to ask ourselves, you know, why might that be the case? And you can imagine all sorts of things from like access to information. And I think that's really the main one. It's like ability to access and to find information about COVID-19 in relatively short order. But then, you know, what are some other confounders that might be available? So you can think, okay, if you control for someone who, you know, has the same socioeconomic status, living in the same neighborhood, same demographic characteristics, but one has internet and one doesn't, you might imagine that the one who has internet is already a little bit more plugged into social services that has helped them get that internet than the person who isn't. And so maybe those social services are actually the things that are helping them reduce their rates of COVID-19 and not the internet itself. And that wasn't really able to be looked at rigorously in this statistical control design. So there could very much be other what we call confounders that are behind this, even though they tried to control for as much as they could. So the way that I read a study like this is sort of as this like point of interest. You know, I read a study like this and I go like, huh, you know, like that's basically as much as it, you know, as it's able to do. And so it's not that I, you know, that I now believe that giving everyone internet is now going to reduce their chances of getting COVID-19 or future infectious diseases. It could, and there are a ton of other really good reasons to make internet much more widely available, right? Yeah. So sure, I can get behind that. Maybe this is one more reason that, you know, one more thing that could tip the balance in favor of giving people internet. But really, you know, scientifically, what this is, you know, begins a narrative in my mind where now, anytime I come across another study that says internet and infectious disease, I'm going to be like, oh, I can put this in the context of this other thing that I've read. And over time, hopefully we can build sort of a scientific consensus where we're looking at this question in a lot of different populations and from a lot of different angles, and maybe even some experiments are done where you give people internet and then you see if that changes their experience with infectious diseases over time. So it's more of a controlled experiment as opposed to, you know, just an observational study. And then maybe we can build up an evidence base about this. So the most important thing is that one study never really gives scientific proof. It's sort of a consensus between an entire set of studies that really, that's the currency by which science operates. And so what this does is it says, it sort of raises an interesting question and does a pretty solid initial attempt to give evidence for and against the reason why internet access may or may not affect a person's experience with COVID-19. And so really, for me, what this does is it sort of earmarks this sort of thread of thought, and I'll sort of carry it with me as I go forward in my research.
That's great. Awesome. I love that. One of the things I wanted to end on is this whole long COVID thing. This is always, it's funny because I read a number of articles and I just kind of been stacking them in a little area for us to talk about. And then we end up not talking about it. And because I think you brought it up before we got on the air. So this is why I'm going to bring it back to the surface, because I read these things like memory and concentration problems affect 70% of long COVID patients living with COVID, long COVID becoming a pediatric public health crisis. So these things keep percolating, right? And I want to talk about them because I know we have listeners who have actually emailed us saying they suffer from long COVID. So it's not like I don't have a care about it or I'm not trying to be empathetic, but I've always struggled to bring it into the discussion because I don't even know where to go with it. And I think you helped to like pin this of like why this is such a complicated reality. So I wanted to bring it right back into this discussion as we end this episode of like, yeah, A, have you heard anything about long COVID, that kind of stuff? But B, I think more importantly, is why is this such a complicated topic to talk about when we're talking even about COVID and it's long COVID? Like, it just seems like an anomaly, even though it's not. I'm like wrestling with this psychological, how do I fit this in and you know, and address it to something that we can actually give valuable information to people who are listening.
Yeah. Yeah. So... yeah, there's so much complexity here. And, you know, I also have a number of friends who are still suffering from long COVID effects. And so it's like, you know, it's very real. And I, you know, I've been sort of personally aware of a lot of the frustration of the people who are suffering from it, and this sense of like, you know, why don't we have more information, more answers? Why do I feel like not even, you know, being heard? And so I think, you know, there are so many different aspects to this issue, and, you know, and partly, you know, behind the reason why it's been difficult for us to even sort of like talk about on the podcast, because it is such a complex issue. So I think there are a couple of things in play. So, you know, one of them, and one that I think that I've, you know, been trying to follow is the sense of first belief in a person's reporting of their own illness and symptoms. You know, one of the, there are very well documented studies that depending on your socioeconomic, racial and ethnic, gender status, you're more or less likely to be believed by a physician of, you know, and so if, you know, a person of one set of characteristics comes in and complains of, you know, brain fog and headaches, one might be believed and one might not be. And that's, you know, not across the board, but it's, you know, it's a fairly well-documented trend. Yeah. And so that's part of what may be in play, and that like that at baseline, sort of this constellation of symptoms, you know, there are probably a lot more people suffering from it than are necessarily picked up by the healthcare system, than are necessarily sort of seen and trusted by the healthcare system. And so there are definitely these issues with sort of the healthcare response, but I don't think that's everything either. So another aspect of it is the sort of scientific structure of our medical system. And it's, I think even that phrase is important here, where it is fundamentally scientific, and science is based off of things that you can observe and measure. When it comes to disease, we have things that are signs and we have things that are symptoms. And signs are sort of objectively measurable things, like I had a fever of 103 degrees Fahrenheit, whereas a symptom is something like, I don't know, I'm feeling like a little woozy. And long COVID does have signs, but it is principally made up of by symptoms. And one of the things that a lot of researchers are trying to do is to find signs of long COVID, of, you know, things that you can objectively image or measure that indicate, you know, this is long COVID, or this is a person who might be suffering from long COVID. And the difficulty between having a really science-based medical system is that we often tend, and this is true of science overall, is that we tend to think that things that we can't measure don't exist. And, you know, that really doesn't do us a very good service either, because clearly there are lots of things we can't measure that do very much exist. But I think that's one of the barriers here too, is that we don't really have good measurements for what constitutes long COVID. Adding on top of all of this is that long COVID, the more we dig into it, it doesn't seem like it's a single, syndrome, but actually sort of a collection of things that can manifest in long-term chronic effects from COVID-19. And we have a lot of other diseases for which this is the case. You know, I think about diabetes, which, you know, we already know that there's type 1 and type 2 diabetes, which manifest differently, have very different causes, have very different sorts of treatments that you need. And even within those, there are multiple types of type 1 and type 2 diabetes that also come from different places and need different sorts of treatment. This is true of cancer as well. You know, we have cancer that describes this overarching, you know, set of illnesses, but, you know, different cancers can look utterly different from one another, and again, come from different places and require different sorts of treatment. And I think that may well be true of long COVID here too, that it's actually probably an entire constellation of conditions. And it helps to talk about as a single thing because it sort of raises the awareness of this constellation of symptoms and signs and effects from COVID-19. But there's also this difficulty, which is that when we're studying long COVID, we're actually probably not studying one thing. We're studying 100 different things, and it can be really difficult to sort of find the common threads through that constellation of causes and effects and figure out what it is that we can then do about it. So all of these things are really conspiring to make it really difficult to talk about long COVID in a rigorous scientific way, and leads to a lot of the really well-justified frustration on the people who are suffering from it, because it is a complex problem. And it's one that I think deserves much more attention, even more than it's getting. But even inherently, it's such a complex problem, and it plays on a lot of the weaknesses that are already inherent in our medical system. And so because of all of these things, it is just a complex deal.
Yeah, that's well said. Thanks, Stephen, for putting that in perspective. And I know we'll definitely, you know, try to keep our pulse on it at all times. So if we want to, we want to provide value to this, and we know so many people have suffered from it. And whenever things surface, we want to make sure that people are aware of the resources available, what's been, you know, the leading research on it. But it is a complex reality. You know, we're going to end on one last thing, and we have to go. I have a meeting here in a little bit, and we got to get going, and we'll see in a couple of weeks. But this one article, Steve and I haven't talked about it. I gave it to him to read, but I want you, our listeners, to read it. It's called True Hope Takes a Hard Look at Reality, Then Makes a Plan. I sent this to Mark. For those of you who've listened for a long time, he was part of our podcast, Steven's brother. He loved it. He's a doctor. This really put a lot of things in perspective of dealing with a juxtaposition between optimism and genuine hope. And the reason why I plant this seed is because even though it's a little bit late to the game, because we're kind of all wrapping this up, going to endemic mode, and I don't think we're seeing the crisis as much as we did even 6 months ago when we had that peak. But nonetheless, I think it's still relevant of dealing, especially when you reflect back in early 2020 when things happened, about, you know, first this idea of optimism, you know, 2 week shutdown, this is going to be over with, and, you know, everything's going to flatline, we'll be okay. And then realizing this continues to just surface its ugly head and continue and continue and continue. So optimism turns into despair, right? This idea, it's not going to end, and now this is going to last forever, right? So then there's these emotions that evoke with this word forever. And this article did a great job of showing how optimism isn't necessarily the thing we want to cultivate. We want to cultivate hope. And I'll leave you on this line that the author put here, and then I hope you can go into the show notes and read it yourself. So namely, he realized that hopeful people shared three things in common: goals, pathways, and agency. Although Snyder called these the three components of hope, it may be more useful to think of them as the three conditions for hope to thrive. And so if that piques your interest, it's a little bit longer read, maybe 15, 20 minutes. It'll give perspective of how to live in the context of hope and not optimism as we move forward. It really encouraged me, and I hope it encourages you as well. And that, lands our plane for this episode. Thank you for hanging in there. Thank you for listening. If you want to support us, patreon.com/pandemicpodcast, as little as $5, or one-time gift, PayPal, Venmo, all in the show notes. And as well, please give us a review. You can do that on Apple Podcasts. If you want to get a hold of Stephen, StephenKSSLER on Twitter, or just email me. I will forward it along to Stephen and Mark at matt@livingthereal.com. Okay, guys and gals, have a wonderful week. We'll see you, I'm sure, in 2 weeks-ish, for in one way or another. Okay, see you soon. Bye-bye.